The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Mark Amtower of Amtower & Company, which is entirely responsible for its content.
This is Amtower Off-Center, sponsored by General Dynamics Information Technology. Every week, author, speaker, consultant Mark Amtower gives you his take on what's going on in the world of government contracting. Amtower Off-Center, with your host, Mark Amtower.
Welcome to Amtower Off-Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Mark Amtower. My guest today is Stan Soloway, recently vacated of the Professional Services Council, and I'm not going to ask him where he's going, so don't wait for it. Stan, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mark. It's great to be here again.
I figure when you're ready to announce, you'll announce, and I'll hear with everybody else. So
appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, you know, it works that way. But I can ask you a lot of stuff. So, Professional Services Council for how long?
15 years, almost to the day.
Man.
Yeah.
Quite a ride, man.
It's been a great ride. Nobody can imagine why they kept me that long, but I was very lucky.
Well, I can. You know, I've seen you speaking. You know, we were talking about this before we started the show. I saw you back when Cal Hackeman was still here at Grant Thornton, and you guys used to put on an annual to-do with them. And that was a blast to go to because there was always a lot of good information, and the networking was really second to none.
Yeah, yeah, those are great events. I actually still do them with them every year.
It's
around the Grant Thornton survey.
Well, PSC Cal's not there, so I don't get invited.
Right. So you have to make some new friends.
So what is the state of the professional services contracting arena these days? What's big?
Well, I think the first and foremost thing is that it's less and less a pure professional services sector than it is a broad set of capabilities that have seen the convergence in many ways of technology and traditional professional services in ways that 7, 8, 9 years ago, I don't think anybody was really contemplating, but in the last 4 or 5 years has become more and more evident. If you just look across the spectrum of the requirements of the government and so forth, it's old hat to say that technology is the heart of everything. But what we've really seen over the last several years is the way in which technology has rapidly become part and parcel of traditional professional services solutions. And so you see the rise of digital, the rise of a variety of other capabilities, analytics and so forth, in ways embedded in one place where the lines between services and product have really become blurred. And it's created a very different environment. And just look at what the companies themselves are doing and where they're expanding their capabilities. So I think it's an exciting time to be in the industry. It's challenging for many because there are huge shifts taking place. I've said several times that I feel like the tectonic plates are shifting under our feet. And whenever that happens, there are some who quickly jump and figure it out. There are others who try to figure it out, aren't sure where to go, and there are others who try to resist it. Resistance is futile.
Climate change is not happening.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So it is a time of real change just in terms of where the capabilities and the needs and the mission requirements are going, and I think it's a really interesting time. That said, the other piece of it, and I know we'll get into this more during the show, is I think that the nature of the marketplace is also shifting in ways that could be really beneficial or could be challenging. There's a lot we don't yet know about that, but so it's as I said, a time of real change and an exciting time. I think that there are real opportunities there. I've never bought into the argument that the budget problems we've had is going to cause a collapse of the industry. It's clearly creates challenges for companies. I mean, I don't want to belittle in any way, shape, or form the pressures on margins, the pressure on rates, and the reduction of spend. I mean, that's a real challenge. I don't mean to say it's not. But the industry itself, the foundation of the industry, is really quite strong and is going to do nothing but grow.
Okay. But the thing that I've been watching and it just hadn't been recently, it's been for years now, is the ability of the larger companies to buy mediums and smalls in areas where they need help and, you know, 2 years later start jettisoning pieces of those things. Is this a matter of not being able to digest the whole beast, never having wanted the whole beast, or just not really sure what you got to begin with?
I think that you've seen a couple of different things happening, and I don't think there's any single answer. You know, you have obviously the case with Lockheed, which has grown a large services and IT business, which is publicly very, very openly looking to spin that out and sell it. BAE Systems went through this. L3 just sold their whole national security services group and so forth. And so I think the tendency is to say exactly what you're talking about. But I think you have to break it into segments. For the very large companies that are traditionally manufacturing and platform sort of focused, the services industry doesn't necessarily match up well with their business models. But in the companies that are, in fact, services and technology providers, there are different models and different ways to go forward. So it depends on where you sit in the industry. I think the biggest question in my mind is whether or not traditional merger and acquisition strategy for the bulk of the industry, leave the very, very large players aside because they have a unique situation, whether those traditional strategies are going to be the strategies we see going forward in large part. I think some of the shifts we're seeing taking place in the market could actually argue for a different approach, where different kinds of partnerships and teaming and joint ventures and so forth bring to bear capabilities in the market without having to necessarily buy or control the entire entity. I think you see this particularly in some of the new technology capabilities that are coming out. So I think you're going to see potentially a more of a mix of in the M&A world of strategy as things settle out a little bit.
Do you think that's going to slow the M&A at all?
It depends on sort of what the measure is. I mean, there's a lot of deals taking place. We've not seen the landslide of deals that some people had predicted. I think you're going to see potentially as many deals, but maybe different kinds of deals, more incremental acquisitions. Do you need to be a $10 billion company to be a real player in this market going forward? It really kind of depends on what you're doing, but in many cases, I'm not sure that's the aspiration people need to have anymore.
I think people like Brad Antel and Bill Hoover prove that you don't have to be a $10 billion company to do that for years and years.
Yeah, no, I agree. So. And on the other hand, Salient certainly does. It's certainly pretty active as an acquirer.
Yeah,
but so you'll see a certain degree of it. It's inevitable that the mid sector of the market, which is the bulk of the players, is going to winnow it at some point. I mean, it's going to have to. There's probably clearly overcapacity there, but I don't know that we're going to see a massive restructuring of the kind we saw in the defense space a number of years ago, because it's a very different kind of market.
Okay, you mentioned teaming and joint venturing. I know that SBA pays a significant amount of lip service to particularly the JV side for small businesses. But all the small businesses that I've spoken with about this say every time they try to put together a joint venture, the contracting officers like back burner them to death. Do you hear the same thing?
I hear some of that, absolutely. I think that there's a lot of confusion both on the government side and the industry side around what really is SBA's position on things like affiliation. And ownership. You hear some cases where companies are private equity owned, where they're being told they can't do it because the actual ultimate ownership goes to private equity and the aggregation. Other cases where agencies say, no, we don't worry about that. We're really worried about the individual company. So there's a lot of inconsistency. I think SBA has a lot of work to do in that area and a lot of work to do to help people really understand what the market is. And really the question, and you and I discussed this, I remember several years ago, I think the fundamental question for us to answer from a small business perspective is what is the real purpose of the small business programs? If the purpose is to create small businesses, we're doing pretty damn well. If the purpose is to create businesses that are sustainable, growing enterprises that can grow to their capabilities and ambition, desire, then I think there are a lot of questions that would still have to be answered. And that really leads you into what happens to companies as they transition out of small business and how do we handle that? Do we actually see a $28 million company in the same light that we see a $26 billion company? And the rules today say basically you're the same. And I'm not arguing for a mid-tier set-aside or anything, but I think that from an SBA perspective and how we think about things like, and let me give you one quick example. When we did the recertification rule a few years ago, you know that well, when the SBA said, okay, from now on, when there's a change of ownership or something, we're going to have a recertification so that you didn't have a situation, which we saw in the past, where companies could continue to compete for small business awards for a period of time or what have you. The rule itself didn't bother me a lot because I thought it was logical, but it lacked any context or perspective. And so one of the things we argued at the time is, okay, if you're going to do that, you need to have a parallel rule that says OMB and SBA get together and agree that agencies can't go canceling or terminating contracts for companies that are bought during the life of that contract just because of the mere fact that they got bought. I mean, that just seemed to be, you kill the value proposition of building a company. Those are the kinds of nuances and pieces that we miss. We don't think about small business in the broad sense of all the subcontracting that goes on, and how does that play in, and how do you make sure the subcontracting is quality, not just the slough off work? I mean, there's a whole set of issues there that I think the SBA needs to deal with. Meanwhile, they are, in some cases, very tough on affiliation rules. In other cases, sort of don't even notice it. So it's very inconsistent.
Well, I think, you know, the only consistent thing I've seen is when the Washington Post writes about it, they act very quickly.
Well, you know, even some of those reports that came out, think about the vast, you know, there was all this stuff about companies that were no longer small that were competing for small business or had small business dollars. And a lot of those cases, and I remember when the Hill, this was probably five years ago, one of the Senate committees wrote to 2,500 companies demanding information on how they could possibly have small business credit credited work when they were no longer small. They had been, and in most cases, these companies had either been acquired or made acquisitions. The work that they had that was small business was absolutely legitimately awarded as a small business contract. It just wasn't over yet. And so, you know, we tend to jump, but as you said, at headlines and not really look more broadly at what are we trying to do here?
Good question. We'll find out after the break. You're listening to Amtower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm here with Stan Soloway. You won't be able to find Stan at the PSC anymore, so I suggest if you want to find him, look him up on LinkedIn. Reach out if you have a reason. We'll be back after these messages. Welcome back to Amtower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Mark Amtower. My guest today is Stan Soloway. Of Stan Soloway is not currently employed, probably for about 12 minutes.
Unemployable.
Right. I'm unemployable, but you're not. Well, I don't know. We both suffer that trait of speaking our minds. So, we go back a ways, but I've been monitoring the 1102, the 1105, all of the downsizing that occurred in the early mid 90s, and you were frontline on that activity. So I'd really like your perspective on where all this stuff started hitting the fan.
Well, I think that the downsizing, and again, I saw it really through the prism of the Defense Department, which is where I was in the 90s, the second half of the Clinton administration. And I think the experience was different in different agencies. So there's no doubt, as I've talked to colleagues and friends over the last 20 years who were on the civilian agency side, where we saw some what we popularly refer to in government as salami slicing of the workforce during the downsizing and some of the initiatives related to the National Performance Review. At the Defense Department, what people forget is we fought tooth and nail against a lot of the acquisition workforce downsizings that were being directed by Congress. I used to go for 3 years running. I had to go basically hat in hand, knee on the floor with a very senior member of the Armed Services Committee, begging them not to require us to cut. At that point, the word was they wanted us to cut a total of 125,000 people out of the acquisition workforce. The simplistic analogy that was being used by this particular member of Congress was he was appalled that there were 175,000 Marines and 300,000 shoppers at DOD. And we pointed out that 300,000 number wasn't real. We spent 2 years studying exactly who was in and doing acquisition. But we fought like crazy, and only because the Senate intervened and helped us get waiver authority and so forth, did we not have to cut deeper. That said, so it wasn't all salami slices at the Defense Department. That said, I think a couple of things have happened over the last 20 years that are very concerning. One, and perhaps most important of all, is not the numbers of people. It's that I don't believe personally that our development and education of the workforce has kept pace with what with the market in which they're operating. I had a recent conversation at DAU, which of late under Jim Woolsey is really trying to do some new and different things. But I had a conversation down there around teaching things like business risk and how businesses identify, manage, and mitigate risk, which is the fundamental goal or fundamental essence of a contract relationship. And they were talking about a new course that they had put together. And leave aside the fact we should have been teaching this long ago. It's a level 3 course, which is, for those who are not familiar with the system, a fairly advanced acquisition person.
Right, yeah.
And I said, well, what about the level 1? Well, we think that's a little too early to be teaching this stuff. And I said, but we're requiring contracting officers to have 24 hours of postgraduate business training. I mean, this is not, we're not, these are not elementary school kids.
Right.
So I think we've really not kept pace with the market on sort of business skills. And we've saw that at PSC. As you know, we do these acquisition policy surveys every other year, and year after year after year, this came through loud and clear from the acquisition leadership. Our folks don't have that business acumen. They don't have the technology skills. The second piece of this is it's really affected the workforce and the acquisition community, I think more than any other workforce in government, is the risk aversion. And it's not that people are a bunch of scaredy cats keeping their heads down. It's that they live and operate in an environment where any minor mistake is deemed to be a scandal, and there's an IG or a congressional hearing. And more and more and more over the last 20 years, we've seen, particularly over the last 15 years, we've seen career folks be the ones on the hot seat for just trying to do their jobs. And I remember when Dave Walker was the Comptroller General, and he said in Iraq contracting, there was fraud, there was waste, and there was abuse. He said, but most of it was waste. There was some fraud and there was some abuse, and had to root that out. But that wasn't the real problem. The real problem was waste. Well, waste wasn't a function of people doing things illegally, unethically, or with malicious intent. It was a function of the way the system was operating. It was a function of being in a contingent environment. So it's not something you brush off. You go deal with it. But it was all treated as one. And so you have an acquisition community that's really only recently begun to take some risks. And some of the risks that you see being taken are actually outside the mainstream, whether it's the Buyers Club at HHS, which is really innovative and trying to do different things, or some 500 procurement challenges and contests that we've seen across government, some of which are being done not by the acquisition community, but by the customer base itself to try to get around some of this risk aversion. I don't blame that on the workforce. I blame that on the system and the lack of support and leadership that's been given to the workforce. Finally, on the workforce thing, as we look at the market today and going forward, what I said earlier in the program about the convergence of technology and services and the changing face of the market, PSC made a recommendation a couple years ago that I still think was a really good one, and one that I continue to champion, which is I think it's time to consider creating an entirely new workforce category in government. We talk a lot about IT acquisition cadres and so forth or what have you. That's all fine and good. But if you really look at the models that work in the commercial world, the ones that work, not everything commercial is great.
Right.
We have blended workforces. And I've used the example since 1997, because that's when I first learned about it with the folks when I went down to FedEx and spent a day with their leadership when I was in the Defense Department. And even in those days, you couldn't become a senior executive at FedEx if you weren't both a business expert and a technology expert, because FedEx is basically a technology company. That's the core of how they do their business. And so we at PSC had developed a recommendation for what we call the technology management workforce, a cross-functional workforce capability. You develop it so an individual has multiple skill sets. It's not as bifurcated or siloed. Ultimately, I think we're going to have to get to that, because if you look at every survey that's been done, and I include our now PSC's CIO survey, the acquisition survey, others that have been done by other entities, you find that the gap, we talk about communication and collaboration between industry and government, the internal collaboration and communication in government between customer and buyer is at low ebb. And both sides will tell you that they're really not communicating and working well together.
So, and Dan, that's scary. Dan Gordon's Mythbuster didn't help.
Well, I'm not talking about that. I mean, Dan Gordon, when he did Mythbusters, that was about industry-government collaboration.
Right.
And he said, I remember...
But also the communication side.
Correct. Yeah. And Ann Rung has been pushing that, you know, trying to build that, and the CIOs have been trying to build it. But you hear from the ground that there's a lot of distance between them and a lot of distrust and, you know, whatever it is. And you can't really run the railroad that way.
No, it exacerbates the situation. And again, you know, with the companies I work with, I do work with a couple of large companies. I don't hear the same issues from them on the communication side, at least not as often, and I'm not involved in that. But when I'm advising a smaller company, you know, a 30-person company, I hear pretty much everything. And that is a constant that I hear.
Yeah, I think there's that. But then the other one, the internal piece of the workforce piece that I was talking about, I agree with you. I'm not the workforce piece is that you have so many cases. We talk about low price, technically acceptable buying. I can point to a half a dozen cases where we've been able to define the problem as the contracting folks having one approach, deciding this is the way to go, not at all reflecting what the customer thinks they're getting or what the customer wants. And so we've had agents, we had one head of one agency direct their acquisition folks to pull a large procurement off the street because the program folks were coming to him and saying, we're not getting the quality we want because of the way the acquisition is being constructed. When you're buying analysts sophisticated analyst time at $60 an hour, you're not getting the best analysts in the world.
No.
When you're, there was one at one Navy command, I'll just share this with you as an example again, where these were engineering contracts, or actually two engineering contracts, and the Navy has a process called tripwires, where if you get over a certain level, you have to get higher level permission. If you get over a certain hourly rate, you have to get higher level permission. And so somebody did an analysis of where these contracts fell with regard to the tripwires, and the tripwires in these cases were $120, $150 an hour for the kind of sophisticated engineering they were looking for, and they were awarded at the administrative level of $55 an hour. That's for administrative support. And at some point, the program offices started saying, wait, you can't get the quality we need to do that that level of engineering at the same level that we've agreed is a reasonable price to pay for an admin. And so that gap is driving behaviors and tensions inside the government. That's another argument to get the workforces on the symbol, get them aligned from an incentive structure. And there are ways to do that. And again, Rung has done some interesting things along that line. But that also suggests to me and to a lot of us that it's time to really rethink the structure of the workforce and how we're doing things that way.
Cool. All right, we're going to take a break. You're listening to AmTower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm here with Stan Soloway. We shall return after this. Welcome back to AmTower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Mark AmTower. My guest is Stan Soloway. Stan is just recently vacated as president for 15 years of the Professional Services Council. Many of us were surprised to hear that he was vacating, and all of us are anxious to hear where he's going, but you're not hearing that today. So just another teaser, Stan. But what you are going to hear today is a little more about all of the changes in the procurement arena and all of these GSA initiatives, which for many of us are confusing, but I think you ferret through most of them much better than most, so please have at it.
Yeah, I think they're maybe a little confusing to folks, but I want to preface what I'm going to say by making clear that I think the combination of initiatives at GSA that they've begun over the last several years, category management, the acquisition hallways, strategic sourcing, and so forth, when you lay it out from a strategic perspective organizationally, you go, that makes a lot of sense, what they're trying to do. The question I have is really in execution and whether or not we have the infrastructure and the skill sets to do it right. So let me just, a couple of questions that need to be answered. It's not a criticism of what they're doing. If you think about what we talked about a little while ago about the gap between the end use customer and the buying community, are we going to exacerbate that gap by increasingly using other agency, GSA capabilities as the buyer for agencies? I mean, that's been there for a long time, but if it continues to grow, does that exacerbate some of those gaps? I think that there is a potential misconception or at least a semantic misuse in some of what's been done, because when you hear some folks at GSA talk about things like strategic sourcing or particularly category management, they talk about focusing on three initial commodity areas, two of which are software development and professional services. And I know a lot of folks that I deal with in the technology and professional services world sort of bristle at the idea of when they say commodity, because some professional services are in fact commodities, some software is a commodity, but a lot of software is under constant development. It's not a commodity. And how you distinguish between the two and make sure people are making the correct decisions and thinking right about it is a question which is really driven by the level of sophistication of the workforce itself. Think about the prices paid portals that are being developed. We have calc.gov now, which is really just a slightly better way of seeing already publicly available GSA schedule prices. But the goal is to create an actual prices paid portal where folks with clearance, internal access and clearance, it's not a public site,
right,
can actually look at what Soloway or AmTower charged for an engineer 5 in 2015 so that you get some comparison as to what they're asking to be paid today or in 2017. Does that make sense? Absolutely. I mean, that anybody who manages workload always wants to see historic pricing. The problem is that when you start getting to things like professional services or even software or other things, there's so many nuances to each individual project that are almost impossible to capture in a database. And so as I'm running a professional services firm and I've got a customer on the right that has a really terrific internal workforce, but needs program management support and engineering support of a certain kind. And a customer on my left hand who does not have as strong an infrastructure, has a very similar need and requirement. How I allocate my company talent to those projects is going to be dependent on what the customer needs so I can deliver the best. And by the way, my people may not get paid exactly the same, because not even if I'm on paper the same person, I am not actually the same person in execution. And so a lot of the nuances of professional services, and this is also true in the technology space, could potentially get lost in a data-driven environment where we're making decisions basically solely on numbers. And so how you figure that piece out is also really important. And then you see the sort of the broader shift to GSA. And again, I'm not saying it's the wrong thing to do, because I think the jury's out on this. But I look at a contract like OASIS, which was originally designed to provide complex integration capabilities, services that would really do complex integration, but has ended up being really a conduit to multiple schedules with one stop. That's how the Air Force is using it for all of their SETA work they're putting through OASIS. Really, it's a one-stop shop for four or five different schedules that they can. It makes it a little bit easier. Air Force is the most aggressively using it. Army has said they now have an agreement with GSA where they're going to at least recommend it. It's a preferred source, not mandated. DHS has said that TABS is when it expires, that work will shift over to OASIS. There are a couple of entities within HHS that have started to say we're looking at OASIS as a possible replacement for some current contract vehicles. That may be great. It may not be great. I think it's always a little bit dangerous to look at one contract vehicle and say it's the answer, because there's always a better mousetrap. But I think these are questions that need to be discussed and talked about, and not assume that it's automatically the best answer out there. It's not too many years ago, people you and I both know who were leading DHS didn't want to use other agency vehicles, because their line was, at the end of the day, we have such a vital mission and it's our butts on the line. We want to control and make sure that we're getting what we need. That attitude is shifting. That suggests a greater degree of trust and faith in the capabilities that GSA can bring to the table. Again, not all negative here, but a lot of questions I think that we need to continue to ask, and a conversation that needs to continue.
Right, but there's also the issue that your 1102s are still the most overtaxed people,
absolutely
work-wise. So you know, offloading to GWACs that have proved successful elsewhere is not a bad strategy on the surface.
Right. Sometimes the strategy makes some sense, but let me play out a different scenario.
Go.
So leave alone the question of how much I offload work to GSA or outsource my procurement to GSA. Let's think about, what does the 1102 world look like 5 or 10 years from now? And I think a very strong argument can be made, if we do it right, capital I, capital F, if, you may well have a much smaller 1102 workforce, because the ubiquitous availability of data, instant availability of data, will allow program offices to do a lot more instant acquisition on their own, perhaps with a contracting warrant of some sorts. I mean, you can't just go do it. But they're going to have all the data right there at their fingertips. I mean, that's where the world is going. And so the basic stuff they need, the kind of routine commodity purchases, are going to be able to be done much quicker, much more efficiently, leaving the more complex work for that 1102 community. So the 1102s that are still there, that community is going to be doing primarily focused on really complex stuff. This is a question that was raised about 8 or 9 years ago as we talked about the workforce size. And I remember, you remember Jack Gansler, who was the Undersecretary of Defense in the 90s, who I worked with, and somebody asked him, and I remember being asked this in testimony on the Hill, how many people do you need in the workforce? And my answer was, we don't know, because there are so many new tools out there. As much as the government relies on acquisition, and it is a core function of government, it's one of the most important things government does. 50% of the budget goes out in contracts. There are so many tools out there that are going to enable massive efficiencies in how we do it, and then enable us to really focus on the complex stuff. What we've seen in recent years is, you've heard me argue before, that I can't understand why we're managing fixed price contracts as if they were cost type contracts. So a company has a fixed price competitive bid, and all of a sudden they're getting all these cost submissions and all this stuff. And the answer is, I said for $1 million, here's what I'm going to deliver, and I delivered it. But they still want to see, did Johnny really work 12 hours and Susie work 9? All of which are things that you shouldn't need to worry about in a fixed price environment, because by definition and under regulation, it's the low risk contracting. Well, if we can get away from that mentality and into really focusing on the higher risk stuff, you could see a different construct of the acquisition workforce, which then makes your the question of overwork and overload a different question.
It'll be a different question, but I mean, go back to something that you referenced earlier. What gets thrown on that dashboard as a commodity? How high up are they raising that particular bar, particularly when it comes to services?
Yeah, I, one of the things I worry about, so the example I gave you a little while ago with the Navy command. So let's say that Navy command's information of the $55 an hour engineers or the intelligence community agency that was paying is paying $60 for analysts goes into the prices paid portal. And 2 years from now, a company is bidding and a contracting officer goes to the prices paid portal and says, well, they were only charging $60 an hour back in 2014 or 2015. You go, yeah. Do you have any idea what was going on in the environment in 2014, 2015, how suppressed rates were? Yet that now becomes the baseline.
That's scary. That's frightening. You're listening to AmTower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'll be back to wrap this up with Stan after these messages. Welcome back to AmTower Off Center on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I am Mark AmTower. My guest today is Stan Soloway. Look up Stan on LinkedIn because I'm not giving out contact information. So reach out to him that way. Do you do Twitter?
I do, at Stan Soloway.
At Stan Soloway. There you
go.
Tough
one to remember.
Might be easier that way. Who knows?
Although my last tweet was about airlines, but that was yesterday.
We irritated?
Oh, my. Yeah, I think my comment was there may have been a weather crisis over the last couple of days with the airlines, but the one I was flying, there was no excuse for incompetence and rudeness. I get that there's a crisis.
Well, there's never an excuse for rudeness, but that's just me. So we have this New Year thing occurring around us. What are the hot topics for 2016?
Yeah, I think there's a couple and I'm going to take this at really a policy level at this point, since it's the last year of the administration, last year of this Congress. So there's a couple, I'd say two big policy issues and one sort of trend issue that I'm watching really with interest and involved in. The first is what's going to happen this year with the National Defense Authorization Act. Now, the defense bill is not the only bill that matters in Congress, but it typically sets the stage for acquisition and technology reforms. I mean, of course, it's how FATARA finally got through, was through a defense vehicle and so forth. And often what happens in the defense bill then ultimately becomes government-wide. And what was little noticed, not little noticed, but less noticed this past year in the defense bill was some of the most impactful and important acquisition and technology provisions that we've seen maybe in a decade or more, particularly with the legislation declaring pretty clearly a preference for the government to use commercial items, commercial practices, and commercial techniques. There has been a schizophrenia in the agencies around commercial items and whether something's commercial or not. There's been a movement, particularly at DOD, to tie whether something's commercial to how it's priced, which I find a little illogical. I mean, a coffee cup is either commercial or it's not. How it's priced is a whole different issue. Congress weighed in pretty strongly in the defense bill, and this came out of the Senate side more than the House side even, that really want an emphasis on commerciality, and I think that's really important. There was also some other provisions around things like other transactions authority and other tools that DOD has to strengthen their ability to access commercial technology and enable prime contractors to access and bring in as part of their capabilities, new commercial capabilities. So that, I think the next generation, the 2016 version of the bill is going to be very important because there's already writing going on to take it to the next level. How deep and how far it goes, I think will be a real question. And there's a group of us are involved in some discussions about where that heads. The big policy fight that I think how much attention it gets, we'll see, but I think it's really seminal, is going to be over the rules implementing the president's executive order called Fair Pay and Safe Workplaces. The administration has issued more than a dozen executive orders over the last several years, primarily in the labor and related environment, aimed specifically at government contractors, not because in most cases, even the White House said they thought there was a particular problem with contractors, but because it was the one part of the environment that they felt that they could control legally and they would have trouble getting these things through Congress. And so some of the executive orders we were perfectly fine with, totally agreed with the intent, worked very well with the administration on implementation. Fair Pay and Safe Workplace is the granddaddy of all of them, and it has the potential to have a significantly chilling effect on the market. It will be really the first time ever that under regulation, a company could be declared non-responsible under the responsibility determination. In other words, effectively suspended from government work merely on the basis of allegations of wrongdoing.
Allegations.
So the idea of the Fair Pay and Safe Workplace Executive Order is to make sure the government's not doing business with crooks. And I think that's perfectly appropriate. I think everybody agrees that there are labor laws that companies have to abide by, just like there are tax laws they have to abide by and environmental laws and so forth. And we shouldn't be giving government contracts to companies that routinely and willfully ignore or violate the law. Not a debate on that. This executive order is so sweeping, so lacking in any objective criteria that it's going to create a nightmare. And it actually says in the executive order, what happens very quick is that every time you submit a bid, you will need to certify in the bid whether or not you have any violations of any one or more of 14 federal labor laws and some untold number of state and local labor laws. So just you have to, whether you have a violation. And then they go on to define the violations. And a violation is not just a judicial finding or an administrative finding, which some would argue is not yet a final adjudication. The settlements without findings are considered a violation or potential violation. Allegations are considered a violation. And so you have to report all of this. And then some wizard, the Department of Labor in conjunction with a contracting officer, decide whether or not you have a pattern of willful abuse and whether you should or should not be enabled to get a government contract. The definitions are way out of line. The language is broad and sweeping. There are significant, very significant due process questions. And we probably butted heads on this as much as any issue in this entire 8 years of or 7 years of the Obama administration with people that we've worked otherwise quite well with in many areas. So it's a tough fight. The rules will be coming out in the next couple of months.
Why did this evolve?
This was really, it actually has its genesis back in the Clinton administration. People forget that the last official act, or one of the last official acts of the Clinton administration in 2000, was the issuance of what we called at the time the blacklisting rule. And this was a similar rule, but it wasn't just about labor law violations. It had RICO and tax and environmental and everything else in it. Mm-hmm. Was driven by a single case, I got to be very frank, I won't say where it took place, but a very egregious case of a company that was, in fact, just thumbing its nose at the law and was, because of the nature of the work they were doing and how significant a player they were in this one narrow niche, was continuing to get pretty significant amounts of work. And so there was an issue. But the response, the blacklisting rule, was way over the top. And when I was at the Defense Department, we fought like crazy against it internally. Had some pretty heated arguments. And then we went all the way up highest levels in the West Wing. When you're sitting there having an argument with the counsel to the president saying this is crazy. The administration issued it, and then the first thing the Bush administration did was rescind it. So this is the grandchild of that in some ways, but it's really driven by a perception that companies are willfully and wildly just ignoring labor law. Well, when you look at things like the Service Contract Act or the Davis-Bacon Act, it's really hard to find any company that has work covered by those acts that doesn't have a violation here and there because they are so complicated to implement. So complex and confusing. And so it has always been considered, absent egregious cases like the one I just mentioned, a course of business where it's a matter of enforcement by DOL and companies pay fines or whatever, but it's sort of like tax law. It's very confusing. And people have what are considered to be violations technically, but in fact are administrative errors. And they pay the price for it, whatever it might be. But this blew up into this really massive rule. And I think this is a really, really big deal because it could really have a chilling effect. And you talk about the administration wants to bring new innovators into the government. I was talking to a group of startups on the West Coast 3 months ago. And the first question one of them asked me was, what is this fair pay thing we keep hearing about? And it wasn't that they don't want to pay fair. It was, tell us about it because we've heard something about this. And they're like, well, there's no way we're going to go into a system with that. And we're trying to bring innovation into the government. So it just goes against everything we're trying to do. It will ultimately end up in the courts. There's almost certainly going to be a major legal fight over this. And
will it end up in the courts before the end of the administration?
I think it depends on what the rules say and how the rulemaking seems to be going. But I would not be surprised if court action doesn't start this spring.
Okay. So would it be precipitated by somebody... or a company being barred from doing business That's
no. I think actually there's a whole coalition of organizations that would surprise the heck out of a lot of folks. Universities, business. There's just this really interesting group of, and we've been part of leading of interests that are saying this thing is so far over the top, and the unintended consequences are so enormous.
So they're not going to wait.
I think if the, this is my guess, I don't know for a fact, but my guess would be if the rules, you know, once the executive order is issued, the rules implementing them have to adhere to the executive order. So they have a certain limit of flexibility here.
Right.
But when the rules come out, if it's a interim final rule as opposed to specifically just a proposed rule, so in other words, it goes into effect even as it's being finalized, you would almost certainly see a move for an injunction immediately.
Yeah. Wow. All right. Stan, give me some final thoughts for people going forward here.
We are in a crazy budget world. We've got certainty of sorts for the next 10, 12 months.
That none long. Of that,
yeah, it's, you know, the new normal is, you know, you take what you can get. I think that the opportunities, and despite all the negatives and the challenges we've talked about today and some of the uncertainty with where we're going market-wise, I actually think that by and large, over the next several years, you're going to see more opportunity for new ideas and creativity in the government that we've seen since I've been around in this business. And I give a lot of credit to the folks who are willing to step out front on some of these things. I mentioned the Buyers Club. It's not the only thing, but what they've done at HHS is very creative. Not perfect, but it's very creative. I think that you're seeing more and more willingness now to think about how we can really change the move the needle and shift paradigms, to use a couple of overused terms. And I think the next several years in this industry, but also in the government, are going to be really, really interesting. We're in the early stages of a massive generational shift. The technology workforce is just beginning that shift. The acquisition workforce is well into it. So we've got about 40% acquisition people with less than 5 years of experience. On the technology side, for every IT professional under 30, we've got 10 that are over 50. That's going to start to shift. And that ratio, by the way, is not getting any better. But it will start to shift. And that, I think, portends some really interesting and exciting times.
Stan, thanks for coming in. Keep me in the loop on where you're going next.
Absolutely.
Always a pleasure. This is not my day job. If your company needs advice on the marketing side of selling to the government, please give me a call. Also, my Government Market Master Program offers two four-hour workshops each month. You can find information on my blog at federaldirect.net, and you can find the information in the Government Market Master Group on LinkedIn. And thank you very much for listening to AmTower Off Center.
You've been listening to AmTower Off Center, sponsored by General Dynamics Information Technology. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. AmTower Off Center, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.